Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today spent 34 years in wildland firefighting. Chuck Sheely was a smoke jumper for the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management for 9 seasons in Oregon and other states, and 4 seasons in Alaska. He's vice president of the National Smoke Jumper Association and editor of Smoke Jumper Magazine since 1999. He's a graduate of Chico High School and Chico State. He taught physical education at Chico Junior High School for 36 years and coached track and field at Chico High School for 53 years. The magazine that he edits printed numerous articles about smoke jumpers who worked for the CIA over a 25-year period. Many accounts cover events that won't be found in history books. The involvement of smoke jumpers in large U.S. government operations like the Bay of Pigs is known only to a small number of people. Chuck Sheely, welcome.
Good to be here, Nancy. Thank you.
Now, the very title, before I even opened your book, was shocking to me. Smoke jumpers and the CIA?
It's a connection that very few people know about. When I was training smoke jumpers in the mid-60s in Oregon, a number of our people were leaving and disappearing to Southeast Asia and working for called Air America. And we were all young, dumb, and didn't know any better at that time.
Did you even know who owned Air America?
Hadn't the slightest idea. All we knew was that this was something exciting. This is something that smoke jumpers can do. We're air cargo specialists. And you could make, at that time, $50,000 a year, which was humongous. And if you stayed there 18 months or were able to last, it was tax-free. I don't think that even got into the mind of the people.
Well, how did the CIA even imagine that they could use the services of smoke jumpers?
Well, when I took over the magazine and I wanted to, number one, this is a recording of history, because right now my objective with the Smoke Jumper Association is to record history, since it's such an unknown part of what we do in the United States. Back in about 1950 or 51, after World War II, the OSS turned into the CIA. The way I have it at this point, two CIA people came to Missoula, Montana, wanted to be trained in how to parachute into inaccessible areas. When they got back to Washington, D.C., said, hey, we have a cadre of people who already know how to do this.
So we don't have to train our own smoke jumpers.
No, they've been doing it for 10 years. Initially, 9 smoke jumpers were recruited. 6 of them went to Taiwan or Formosa on the Taiwan project. 3, I haven't been able to figure out what part of the world they went to. But this was the initial start, was the Taiwan program, when we were training nationalist Chinese paratroopers to jump back into the mainland islands. And I guess at that time we thought we were going to take China back. But that wasn't very good thinking in the long run.
My guest is Chuck Sheely, and he is a former smoke jumper, and you trained smoke jumpers.
That's right.
And you're editor of Smoke Jumper Magazine. So what your book is that you've put together, your name does not appear anywhere on the cover, Chuck. And why did you not put your name on the cover?
This was a collage of different articles. And I thought, wow, if I put my name on, that's not really right. I encouraged a lot of these articles. I was a ghostwriter in a lot of these articles. But there are also a lot of articles in here that were written by other individuals, and even some articles written by newspaper people who got these gentlemen to talk in their later years. I found out that there wasn't much talking going on after the Vietnam War. As these people reached their 70s, and even a couple in here their 80s, they wanted to tell their story. And that was part of my job, is to get this story told. But again, I didn't write all these. I ghost wrote some of these, but not all.
Well, even the word smoke jumpers, I thought I knew what a smoke jumper did, and this expanded my idea of the services that smoke jumpers provided. So when you were training smoke jumpers, what did you train them for?
Well, we have to take, number one, they have to be a wildland firefighter. That's the key. Smoke jumpers get to a fire just by a different vehicle, an airplane and a parachute, as opposed to hotshot crews, which have their own vehicles. So we had to take a wildland firefighter and train this person. And I will say him, because at that time they were all males. We didn't have females till 1982. We had to train them in parachute function. And this is not the military type parachute function where they drop in what are called drop zones. We have to drop people in a very small area, sometimes on ridgetops, on the edge of canyons. I jumped in southern Oregon where we had 200-foot Doug fir. There's a lot of techniques that have to be involved in the training, and smoke jumpers actually started, as far as I could find from my research, the steerable parachute program way back in 1942. So smoke jumpers had steerable parachutes, and this is way ahead of the skydiving and sport parachute industry.
Well, I have a friend who was trained by the Army to jump in a parachute, and he, when he got out of the Army, was interested in becoming a smoke jumper. But even though he was trained to parachute out of airplanes, you would have had to retrain a person like this to be a smoke jumper.
That's right. I found out the most difficult people to retrain were ex-airborne.
Because they thought they knew.
Well,
I would
right.
guess.
Yeah, and it's a completely different ballgame. And finally, after a few years, we stopped hiring the airborne people. After World War II in 1946, when the smoke jumper program reinvigorated itself, I'd say 99% of the people were ex-military, and a great percentage of those were airborne people. My boss at Cave Junction, Oregon, was 101 airborne, jumped at Market Garden. That's the bridge too far, and then Bastogne and that sort of thing. So, but it evolved as time went by.
Well, you mentioned a steerable parachute, and that idea to me was novel. And so I asked my friend, steerable, could you steer your parachute? And so he went on to explain how that was possible. And it wasn't always possible. So maybe people would be interested, how do you steer a parachute?
Well, I'm going to equate back to your friend. When you're dropping 500 airborne troops, you don't want them to steer. That's the last thing you need is 500 drivers in the sky. In 1942, a gentleman called Frank Derry, whom I think is just a pioneer parachutist, put in what are called Derry slots. And they looked at some cargo chutes with big rips in the back, and they found out that, wow, even though this chute was ripped, it seemed to get to the ground okay. So he put in guidelines, put in what are now called Derry slots with suspension lines that turned into steering lines, redirecting airflow. And this is how he came up with a very good steerable parachute.
My guest is Chuck Shealy, and he is editor of Smoke Jumper Magazine. And he has collected articles from Smoke Jumpers Magazine into a book, Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. Now, how many stories do you have in your book? Have you counted how many stories you have?
You caught me off guard there.
Oh.
I'm guessing 30. When another gentleman, who's a smoke jumper, sat down and put this together, and this is Stan Collins from Eugene, Oregon, we had maybe 75 or 80 different articles. And then we had to start doing the cut thing, like a film director goes into the room and leaves a lot on the floor. We had to leave a lot on the floor, but we couldn't publish War and Peace again. So we had to do something that was readable.
Yeah. And these stories, you've got guys from little small towns, and they go home and they have this big fat check. And in a small town, you know everybody. You know the banker. And the banker's going to wonder, hey, how'd this kid get this big fat check? How did they cope with that?
Well, that was some amazing stuff. And a lot of their checks were sent home and even deposited at these banks ahead of time. And that's the key. How does a kid from nowhere, Montana, get sizable checks like this? And then, and I still don't have the answer of how they deposit, but in small towns, you probably went to school with the banker's kids and that sort of thing. it was interest the normal. I'm going to say normal. There's not such thing as a normal smoke jumper. Okay, when the regular smoke jumpers saw these guys come back, they say, "Well, where have you been this winter?" Oh, working in the woods. Interesting that you have such a good suntan. So then the story started floating around, and these guys wouldn't talk. And
well, they couldn't really.
No, they
could.
If
you're working for the CIA, you better keep your mouth shut.
Right. And then when you get to the part of the book, I have the list. And that is, it is a very accurate list of the 97 smoke jumpers that worked overseas, and that does not include the ones that were working in parachute development down at Marana, Arizona. So that list is accurate. I know because I ran it through a series of people who – there's still six people that should be in that list who won't let me use their names. So
yeah, I can understand
that's what
that.
We're dealing with.
Yeah, I can understand that. So you collected these stories, and – a lot of these kids are from small towns, but it's not a year-round job apparently, because you had your own job as a coach, and you taught physical education, and you're a track and field coach, and yet at the same time, so for all those years, you were also a smoke jumper and training smoke jumper. So how did your year shape up? How did you manage that?
Well, it was a good deal. After dealing with junior high kids for 9 months, it was almost a relief to go out and fight fires. After fighting fires for 3 months, I was ready to get back to the kids again. It seemed like in some years, I'd leave Chico Junior High, I'd shut the doors on Friday afternoon. I'd be on a plane to Fairbanks Saturday morning and be actually doing refresher training Sunday afternoon.
So you were able to have these dual careers because they had their own season.
Oh, they did. And then after I got out of smoke jumping, I ran what is called the Type 2 program, crew program for the Mendocino National Forest, which is headquartered over here in Willows. And I took college students from Chico State and UC Davis, and for 18 years I trained them to be wildland firefighters. I think our program, we trained between 3,000 and 4,000 young people to be wildland firefighters, and 23 of those went on to become smoke jumpers. Two of them went on to become smoke jumper-based managers, and a lot of times when I go around to firefighter events, I run into people who are high up in the food chain right now.
Well, it takes a special kind of person to be attracted to this kind of work. And I was interested in this story about this young kid who at 16 said, "I'm going to be a smoke jumper." And I can just imagine, identify, of course, with his mother. Said, "Oh, no, you're so young." I don't know the conversation. You don't reproduce this in your book. But I can just imagine. Tell that story of that young a kid at 16 who knows he wants to be a smoke jumper.
Well, this was John Lewis. And I think, if I remember correctly, he's from Texas. His brother-in-law is actually is an ex-smoke jumper, and his brother-in-law was also over there in Southeast Asia. His brother-in-law is named Ken Hessel, lives in La Grande, Oregon, and Ken was one of my main sources to verify who had been there and who had not been there. And
in fact, you give him credit. Your chapter 19, The Youngest Smoke Jumper, a biography of John Lewis, is written by Ken Hessel.
Yeah. I want to add that John Lewis and the two other young men that were killed in the early plane crash in northern Laos, I think it was 1963, somewhere in that area there, their stars have been added to the CIA wall just over a year ago in a ceremony in May. And, of course, the stars on the CIA wall, there are no names there. There are these three smoke jumpers, and then there's one other smoke jumper who I haven't been given permission. I know who it is, but I can't, you know, I would
publicize.
Like to write his. Yeah, I'd like to write his story sometime. So there's that 127.
So you still have work to do.
Oh, I do. I do. I'm running out of time.
Well, this story about John Lewis, this young smoke jumper, the first sentence, he packed a lot into his short 26 years. And when I read that, my heart broke just reading that sentence, because you know this kid's only going to live to be 26.
Yes, and you know, Ken Hessel's wife Leah's John's sister, and whenever we have smoke jumper gatherings, you could see it still hurts.
Yeah, because you say the author now, Ken Hessel, says that as John's sister-in-law, my wife Leah, tells a story, it was with great trepidation that she and her mother drove John a few miles out of this little town in Texas, June 3rd, 1953, and let him out on Highway 183 North. Once out of the car, he told them, head for town and don't look back. His mother cried all the way home, feeling certain she would never see him again. And he is so young, he sets out totally confident that he's going to accomplish it. This is now imagination that he's going to accomplish this dream. And he puts out his thumb and hitchhikes.
Well, in addition to John Lewis, there were 9 other smoke jumpers that were killed over there. 5 years ago, myself and 3 other jumpers went back into Vientiane, Laos. This was the base in northern Laos, sometimes called Shangri-La, the most hidden place on earth. This is where the CIA ran their operation at that time. It was the world's second busiest airport. After writing so much about Longchin and this secret base and stuff, I just had to see it, whether or not people were there or not. And things are overgrown. The airstrip is now very narrow. There's a lot of Chinese in there. The Chinese are doing water projects. But I had to get in there, so the trip was worth it.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with Chuck Sheely, editor of Smoke Jumpers magazine. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is Chuck Sheely, editor of Smoke Jumper magazine, and also a collection of articles entitled Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. Chuck, I found out about your book from a friend who had read it and thought, oh gosh, this is such an interesting book. Nancy should know about this. And it was shortly after that I saw a guy with a cap on that said Smoke Jumpers. I thought, oh my goodness, I'll bet he knows you. He not only knew you, but he thinks you walk on water. You have a lot of admirers out there, Chuck.
Well, I know that gentleman. His name is Bob Hooper. And when Bob came out of Chico State, I think I was his master teacher when Bob became a teacher. And Bob went from there and coached at Marysville, and then he went into the service and on from there. As a matter of fact, I just had lunch with Bob the other day. His house is in Paradise. So while he was down here in Chico taking some class, his house, or at least the road, was closed. Fortunately, his house is safe. So as a member of the Smoke Jumper Association, I am trying to contact our ex-smoke jumpers. There are 6 or 7 who actually live in Paradise. And this is going to be it's going to take months to tie in. We have what's called the Good Samaritan Fund, where we try to help smoke jumpers and their families in times of need. So you mentioned Bob, and Bob's okay.
That's good to hear, because those of us who are kind of on the sidelines, I might say, just so appreciate the work that the firefighters do. And I think they get that message.
They do. And I go back to smoke jumping. It's something we would have done it for zero pay. So,
but you get, in addition to pay, you get the appreciation of this whole community.
Well, agreed. Not much to say.
Well, you have some remarkable stories in here, and we talked about the story of John Lewis. And then you have a gentleman, Ken
Sisler,
and I would like to hear his story.
When I got into the magazine, I wanted to there, and this is going to get outside of the CIA. There were three individuals I want to get background on, three smoke jumpers.
Yeah, in fact, you say you start. Oh. This is chapter 17, and you wrote this article, and you say, "I've always wanted to know more about Ken Sisler. He was a smoke jumper who posthumously was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor after being killed in Vietnam, the sort of background that gets a person's attention." So you had a personal interest in what is this guy's story?
It is. I wanted to write about Stuart Roosa, who was a smoke jumper, the Apollo 14 moon pilot. I wanted to write about Willie Unseld, who was a smoke jumper from Cave Junction, the first man to actually climb Everest from the West Ridge route. And Ken Sisler, I knew we had a Medal of Honor winner in there. And so it just involves getting books and doing research. And then he jumped at North Cascades Smoke Jumper Base in Winthrop, Washington. So I went down the list, and I found people who knew Ken. And I wrote a bunch of letters. And, you know, Nancy, you write 20 letters, and you're lucky if you get two replies. At least I got some replies, and it added to his story. It says, and Ken Sisler's Medal of Honor certificate says he was killed in Vietnam. Well, Ken was actually a member of this SOG, S-O-G group, which—
Which stands for?
You know, I don't even hardly even remember it now. It's
well, Studies and Observation Group.
Okay, thank you. At first, I thought it was a special operations group or something like that. But
it is kind of an unusual name for Studies and Observations Group, a top secret covert operations unit of the U.S. military during the Vietnam War.
And their job was to go in and monitor the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was mainly in Laos. And their object was not to go in and cause a disturbance or anything. They were, as the title says, studies and observation. They were supposed to be eyes and not be seen. Well, as things go, they were seen. And Ken Sisler, you know, did just a heroic thing to get his men out and was killed during the evacuation or the escape attempt.
Well, you say that this organization, Studies and Observations Group, which you refer to as SOG, was steeped in secrecy. It was formed in 1964. Steeped in secrecy, its members, an elite group of warriors that included Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and Air Force Air Commandos, answered directly to the Pentagon. These forces saw combat, took part in hundreds of rescue operations, and handled cross-border reconnaissance deep in enemy territory. More than 150 of the members of this SOG died in the war, and 80 more were reported missing in action. Now, you mentioned in that paragraph Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and Air Force Air Commandos, because when I was reading about these smoke jumpers, I thought of the Green Berets and the Navy SEALs. I thought, boy, these guys have what it takes to be special forces.
Well, actually, when you go back to the establishment of the underwater demolition teams, which became the Navy SEALs later, we've had smoke jumpers involved in all of these activities in the military. So it is the same type of individual.
Well, you know, we think of the military, for example, as being, yes, sir, whatever you say, sir, you have to follow orders. But you mention in your book that these are not those kind of guys. You say the CIA had realized in smoke jumpers men who were problem solvers and could get the job done under the most difficult circumstances.
That, I think, is the key that the CIA found with the smoke jumpers. Here they were in Laos. They were running a mirror war to the Vietnam War with a small number of personnel. We had an army of Hmong under General Vang Pao. They were doing a tremendous amount of operations. And when you're out there on these Lima sites, which were different places around Laos, you had to take a problem and handle it and get the problem solved. There was no 911 to call. And they found out that smoke jumpers were good at that. And these guys, they did a super job.
My guest is Chuck Shealy, and he is a former smoke jumper himself, and he also trained smoke jumpers. And we're learning from his book, what is not in history books, that the CIA contracted smoke jumpers to help them with their secret operations. So this story of this smoke jumper who was awarded a Medal of Honor posthumously, and you say that you had to find out, what was Ken like as a young man?
Yeah, this is when I wrote letters to the people who had jumped with him, and they told the stories, and I just added bits and excerpts from the letters they sent back. And I think one of the last things, if I'm remembering this article right, one of his friends remember they were playing a game of poker in the bunkhouse, and it was almost like Ken got up and said, "Well, I'll see you." And that's when he drove off to the end of the season, and the "I see you" never happened.
Well, we mentioned that this was the first Medal of Honor awarded to this organization, SOG, you refer to in your book, Studies and Observations Group. And in 1967, he was a 29-year-old lieutenant. And he was in the military himself.
Oh, yes. Yes, he was in the Army.
And you interviewed people who knew him to tell his story.
I interviewed people who knew him as a smoke jumper, so they knew him.
After his military career?
No, before. He jumped before he went into the military. So the people I interviewed knew him as a very young man. I think he was a 1957 rookie at Winthrop, Washington. So when Ken Sisler walked out of the bunkhouse and said, "I'll see you," then the military started after that. Of course, back then, we were all draft eligible.
Well, now you mentioned some of these places. Just review for us, where were some of these centers that smoke jumpers were trained or went to?
Just about like we have now. There are 9 smoke jumper bases in the western United States. 7 of them are run by the U.S. Forest Service. 2 of them, Alaska, the Alaska base and the Boise base, are run by the Bureau of Land Management. So you will have we've got a smoke jumper base right up here in Redding, California that's been there since 1959, real, real close. We have Redmond, Oregon. We have Winthrop, Washington. We go over to Grangeville, Idaho, Missoula, Montana, West Yellowstone, and then the 2 BLM bases.
So you've answered to 2 different organizations as your employer, do I call it that?
No, that's exactly right. My first part of my career was spent jumping with the U.S. Forest Service in what we call Region 6 in Oregon. I transferred to the BLM in 1967, went to Alaska, and found a whole different type of organization, a whole different country than what we had down here in Oregon. So I spent 4 seasons with the BLM before coming back.
You know, and when people hear what a long background you have, Chuck, they're going to think, gosh, this guy must be pretty old. But you look so fit. Is it part of this dual occupation that you've had over the years that you're able to stay so fit?
Gee, I don't know. I'd like to attribute to that. I've got so many aches and pains, I'm thinking that the dual occupation is catching up with me. But no, as a physical education teacher, I always figured that we need to walk the walk. And, you know, I'm really into diet and exercise, and even at an advanced age here, I'm still trying to keep that going.
Well, you, I think, are a role model at people. That's one of the things they admire about you. Now, you have a chapter in your book about a guy whose life was just, I mean, you wonder, what is this guy going to do next? I mean, he was in all the places where the action was. And this guy's name is Shep Johnson. And you call this is a chapter that you wrote, chapter 18, More Than an Interesting Life. And You say that for a while now, I've wanted to interview jumpers who worked for the CIA during the so-called secret war in Laos, a U.S. paramilitary operation going on at about the same time as the Vietnam War. I wanted to find out more about the initial connection between the agency and smoke jumpers. And that's what those of us who see the title of your book, that's what we want to know. Smoke jumpers and the CIA? What kind of relationship is this?
Shep Johnson was one of the most interesting characters. And Shep is was an Idaho cowboy. And getting this story out of Shep, this story must have taken 2 years to write, starting a paragraph at a time. First thing, Shep did not use the internet. It ended up that I had to really work through Shep's wife to go back and forth. Shep was involved in early on in just about all phases. You know,
each page I turn, gosh, now here he is in this part of the world, and then he's in this other part of the world, and he's training Tibetans in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So what did you learn about this guy?
Well, after we started getting back and forth, then I met him at a couple of Air America reunions. That's the first thing I had to do. And I said, this guy was an all-time character. I think when he first started writing, you know, he said he was that cowboy out on the range there and it told the foreman it's time to leave and see that cow there. And when that cow... Or when that gate hits that cow in the rear end, I'm out of here. And he said, I went to Washington with a clean pair of underwear and a few clothes and was hoping they would take care of me. Shep was involved in so many projects. You mentioned one of the most unknown projects was training Tibetans.
Yeah, I read that. My gosh, I can never imagine such a thing.
Whoever heard of that? We train Tibetans at Hale Field in Colorado. Where we had some high-altitude training during World War II. And the object was to drop these people back in to provide a resistance against the communists.
But they were our enemy.
Oh, yeah. There are so many dead-end stories here. I don't even want to deal with that. My objective here was to tell the history and introduce people and stories that very few people know anything about. If you were to walk down the street and ask people, and I would think even over at the university here, 99.9% would not even have a clue. Very few people know why we have Hmong here in Chico, why we have Hmong in Oroville and that sort of thing. A lot of the young Hmong people who I've had as in junior high school and senior high school have no idea their background.
They don't even know their own history.
No.
Oh, my. After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Chuck Sheely, editor of Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is former smoke jumper and smoke jump trainer Chuck Sheely, editor of Smoke Jumper magazine, and a book of articles from this magazine, Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. Well, this guy, Shep Johnson, that you thought had such an interesting life, you also mentioned from time to time this other colorful character, if I want to call him that, Paper Legs.
Oh.
You say, I was approached in October of 1959 by Paper Legs Peterson. And he told me I could have an off-season job that paid good money, but I declined. So Paper Legs figured in your history.
Paper Legs Peterson is like a legend smoke jumper. Let's go back to the 1946 smoke jumpers. During the war years, 43 through 45, the smoke jumpers were kept going by the conscientious objectors. They were the Civilian Public Service 103 group. So we had these Mennonites, Brethrens, and Quakers.
Who didn't want to carry a gun.
Right. They volunteered. They wanted to do something more than busy work. And so during those three war years, they kept the smoke jumper program going. Otherwise, I think smoke jumpers might have been stopped at the time. At the time the CPS people came in 43, they were down to four smoke jumpers. So they kept it going. But back to Paper Legs in 46, just about all the CPS people were let go. They were drafted also. So as soon as the war ended, their enlistment ended, they went back to their farms and so forth. And then the veterans came in. I call 46 through 49 the era of veterans in smoke jumping. And Paper Legs was part of that group. He's a World War II paratrooper. And I think he got busted up on a few jumps, and so he got the name Paper Legs. And
because there's another nickname they call parachute jumpers that has legs in it.
Oh, straight leg. Excuse me. The parachute jumpers call the ground pounders. As smoke jumpers, our people on the ground are ground pounders. As airborne paratroopers, the other people are straight legs, right?
Okay, so you have the ground pounders and the straight legs.
Yeah, the civilians and the military non-jumpers, correct.
So I was guessing that Paper Legs was kind of a reference to straight legs.
No, in a way it was because I think he busted his legs a couple times. And so he's a pretty good sized guy. One thing about smoke jumping, the larger body type you had,
the rougher on the joints, I would think.
It is. The more you're going to bust up. At my day, they limited it to 180 pounds. And since parachutes have improved, they've upped it to 200 pounds. And I'm looking at Cave Junction. We had some pretty good athletes and muscular type people there that just dieted to make that weigh in sort of thing. The good thing, if you're 180 pounds when you're packing a 110 pound pack out of a wilderness, that's good for you. The bad thing, I was 150 pounds. I could land in a rock pile and walk away. The 180 pounders, we had to scoop them up.
Because they've got that added weight. It's not just their own body weight, the added weight of the gear that they're wearing.
Added weight of the gear. On a hot afternoon, you have less dense air. The speed you land, you could hit pretty hard. When I jumped in New Mexico in 1961, and all of our jump spots down there were 8,000 feet and above. And by say jump spots, that means where you land. So if you're jumping from 9,000 feet in a hot afternoon in New Mexico, you're coming in at a rapid rate of speed.
My guest is Chuck Shealy, and he is editor of Smoke Jumpers magazine. And he has collected articles from this magazine in a book, Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. And we were just talking about Shep Johnson because he had such a varied career. And the guy you said, when you did decide, okay, I'll be a smoke jumper, you said the guy I was working with came in and told me it was important to get in touch with my boss. And you think, oh, it's like a kid at school being called to the principal's office. And you're like, uh-oh, now what? And what did you think might be why you were being called to see your boss?
You know, I don't know what his thoughts were. Shep was such an interesting person. As I say, when I interviewed him, he's a cowboy, and he was a true cowboy all the way. And
You said you told me to get in touch with your boss. I only thought about my mom was ill or something, and my boss told me to call Ray Beasley, who told me where to report in Washington, D.C. And when I told Ray I didn't have any clothes to go back there, he said not to worry. They'd sent plenty of money.
Ray Beasley's another. Ray was one of the prior ones to Shep going in. I don't know whether Ray had the complete experiences that Shep did. I mean, it seemed like Shep was there everywhere. Guatemala, Bay of Pigs, Tibet.
South Vietnam, Laos,
When the main operation, the secret war was going on, the mirror war to Vietnam, Shep ran all of the cargo operations at Long Chin. Again, the secret base way up. When we went up there, it was near the Chinese border and actually adjacent to the Plain of Jars, and that has some history to it. Just ask the French.
Well, you were just saying that this guy, Shep Johnson, was hired. He worked in Tibet, Laos, South Vietnam. So what did he do in South Vietnam? Do you remember?
He was just back and forth in South Vietnam. The main operations went out of Laos. Shep was involved in this black helicopter program. And you say black helicopter. That's always something you hear on the channels that you listen to at 2 a.m. in the morning if you could do it. They did have black helicopters. It wasn't a black helicopter because it was supposed to be black. Black was a term meaning that they were quiet helicopters. And so Shep was involved in a project in dropping listening devices along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the listening devices took the place of the SOG people. It's easier to have a device hanging in a tree than it is to put individuals in there. So Shep was involved in that project, and that's where I think the reference to South Vietnam came in.
So black was more signified secret.
Yes.
Instead of color.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking Ken Burns needs to do an update of his long series, or PBS series on Vietnam.
This is something that people don't know about. I'm, again, sure that very few people know we had a secret war and know to what extent this war went on for this period of time. After we after the Vietnam War and we evacuated and Vietnam fell in 1975, we still had the Hmong up at Laos, and that's a whole other story for a whole other program about getting those people out of there, and we didn't get very many of them out of there.
Well, as I was reading, I thought, oh, my gosh, there was so much in here that I never imagined going on. And I know people who are skeptical and suspicious of our government, and you read your book, you think, oh, my gosh, what all of this went on without our even knowing it.
That's one of the reasons I want to record history, because at the time when I was training smoke jumpers, going from a rookie smoke jumper to where I was a squad leader and a foreman and training people, and hearing President Nixon say we don't have people in anywhere outside of Vietnam, and I'm just pounding on my wife says it doesn't do any good to scream at the TV. And I'm saying, this is a lie. This is total baloney. I've got some bad feelings about that, and I'm right. I wrote these stories to honor these people because they were people who can do a job. And again, what great
And they could not be given credit for what they did.
Right.
Just like you were saying, they can put a star on there, but they can't attach a name to that star.
No name.
Even now.
That's correct. No names to the four stars. When these last three stars were added to the wall, I got an email from a speechwriter for Mike Pompeo, who is what now our Secretary of State, but he was the head of the CIA at that time. He wanted some details on these gentlemen so that he could do the presentation. And then I went back and forth, and then the Washington Post picked up on this thing, and that got the book a little bit of publicity, and now a young man who has really done some good work for magazines and books is going to take this whole thing and put it into a better written and a better narrative. And he said, you know, this is going to take maybe 3 or 4 years to do. It's tough writing a book.
Yes, and you found that out.
Oh, yeah.
And yet a lot of the writing was already done because there were articles that you'd already published. And so you're doing your research on Shep Johnson, who we mentioned he was in South Vietnam. And then who knew that they were training Tibetans in Colorado, here in this country? And you say, after returning to the U.S., we were sent to, this is now still the story of Shep Johnson, we were sent to Camp Hale, Colorado to train Tibetans. why Camp Hale?
As I remember right, this is where the 10th Mountain Division trained during World War II. Those were our Army people who were supposed to learn to ski, climb mountains. And the altitude is the main thing. We're taking Tibetans who are used to living at
high altitudes where the air is thin.
Exactly, where you and I would have to have oxygen.
Their lungs are prepared for that.
Oh, yeah. That's where they grew up. You know, Shep and these other people said they had never worked with any better people than these young Tibetan men. They were just super. And everyone they worked with disappeared.
Well, you say the high altitude and rough terrain were as close as they could come to Tibet, and so Tibet, so this is why they were training in Colorado. The camp was set up by the U.S. Army for the 10th Mountain Division during World War II, as you were saying, and our job was to train them for airborne operations. And these Tibetans, you said, were not only physically equipped, but they were very motivated and to cooperate. And to my knowledge, they never jumped into Tibet, but walked in instead. Very few of these fighters survived the conflict with the Chinese. They were heavily outnumbered. No Tibetan jumped in Tibet after 1960 that I know of. There was a mission flown in 1962. So they were training Tibetans in Colorado, Shep Johnson was.
But I think I could update this since Shep originally wrote this story. There were Tibetans that jumped in. The way the CIA wanted them to do it, and I think they were flying out of Okinawa, which was one long haul, they had time to do one pass over the drop zone, at which time they dropped the Tibetans and their cargo. So it had to be a quick one pass and then get out of there. Accurate, very accurate. So there's updates from when Shep wrote this.
Events in 1969 and 71, we supported this general in the Hmong army to take the Plain of Jars. And then he says, I was wounded in 1971.
Shep was a world, hold it, take that back. He was a Korean War Marine. I think he had a Purple Heart out of the Korean War. And Long Chin, and the general you're talking about is Vang Pao. And we have a statue of Vang Pao in our city plaza here in Chico. Probably the only place in the United States where you will see a statue of Vang Pao, because we have the Hmong here. So a little bit of Chico history. Back to Long Chin. Toward the end of the war, the North Vietnamese were invading Long Chin. They knew the importance of Long Chin. It was a center of air operations for a lot of things. So the North Vietnamese Army took what is called Skyline Ridge. And when we were in Long Chin 5 years ago, you look up at this tremendous mountain around. That was Skyline Ridge. And so the North Vietnamese or the NVA had Skyline Ridge at this time. And we had called in air operations to save Long Chin. And one of our own planes dropped these little bombies things, which are anti-personnel things, a little smaller than a tennis ball. And we killed a lot of our own people with that and a misdrop. It's a friendly fire sort of incident. And that's how Shep was wounded again.
You say, Chuck, that this secret war ran more than 15 years and probably the most written about operation involving smoke jumpers. And you say the great majority of the jumpers involved here worked as kickers for Air America, one of the CIA's proprietary airlines. So this, not only a secret war, there's so many secrets that you reveal in your book that I think people will be fascinated by the research you have done to uncover these facts. Thank you so much for writing this book.
It was fun. This was, as I said earlier, this was like a 20-year project. I started writing these in 2000, and it's a puzzle, and you put together piece by piece.
Thank you so much, John.
You bet, Nancy. It's been a pleasure.
His book is Smoke Jumpers and the CIA. The author is Chuck Shealy. Next, commentator Richard Parker has a few words for us.
What was responsible for the fire? That is not all the simple question it appears to be. What in law is called the proximate cause of an event is much too narrow to provide a satisfying answer to this question. The sine qua non answer, sometimes called the but-for cause of an event, is only slightly helpful. It says that but for this factor, the event would not have happened. In the present case, it's whatever happened up there on Camp Road near Pulga at 6:30 in the morning of November the 8th, possibly a PG&E problem. But more important in the long run is that any number of things could have been the but-for cause of this fire. A lightning strike during an electrical storm would do very well. So would a spark from a lawnmower blade. I started several fires myself once when, like an idiot, I took a steel-bladed weed cutter after a bunch of star thistle and other weeds on a lot that I owned. A lot with plenty of rocks. Rocks that made sparks when my blade accidentally hit them. I stamped out several small fires that might have become several large fires had there been the right kind of wind blowing and my shoe size just a bit smaller. So lots of things could have been the spark in the tinder. The fact that we've been in a drought for a half a dozen or more years is a huge factor in this year's fires. That nearly every year lately has set records for being the hottest year on record is not exactly irrelevant either. These conditions guarantee that once a fire begins, it isn't likely to end quickly or without consequences. But wait, I'm starting to sound like some myopic environmentalist who can't see the trees for the forest. And everybody knows it's trees that burn in these wildfires, don't they? Our fire manager-in-chief, the orange guy in Washington, tells us so. These fires have resulted, he says, because of long-term mismanagement of the forests by guess who? Democrats. Remember, Democrats have controlled the state legislature for most of the past generation, and the state did vote for Clinton in 2016. If we'd have allowed more clear-cutting in the forests, there would have been fewer trees to burn. But oh, good grief, were you in paradise lately? How much clear-cutting could have been done there? Further, clear-cutting, which seems to be Trump's version of good forest management, causes a great increase of underbrush to grow, and that produces a greater fire hazard than trees. Oh, and another thing. I just read that 2/3 of California forests are on federal land. State lands constitute only 3% of our state's forests. So if mismanagement has been the culprit, we need to look to Washington for the evildoers, not to Sacramento. But everything is politics these days, isn't it? Even catastrophic fires. I sort of remember when we listened to people who seemed to know what they were talking about, rather than to people who repeated the same thing over and over and over until, like Joseph Goebbels predicted, we start to believe it. So, onward. With as many helping hands and open wallets as possible for the survivors of this catastrophe. In the meantime, this is Richard Parker.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.